Bit of a drinker, just between us. You could smell it on him. He'd come couple times a week, and they'd huddle up in the corner and mutter to each other. One time he came when Fred was sick in his room, and sat down there by himself instead. Got talking to a couple of the other residents. Told them all kinds of nonsense. About how he used to work on special aircraft or something. Barking mad. Nobody believed a word of it. But then, a couple days later, these other fellas came. Young guys in suits. Talked to everyone who had been there. Wanted to know what this Siegfried character had been saying. Very bizarre. We never saw him again. Poof. Just like that. Gone.
Tamika looked suitably shocked.
What did Fred say about it? Said they'd had a falling out, said Chuck, skeptically. Weird. He doesn't get visitors anymore. Just this crowd who come over for a barbecue once a month. Rain or shine. Like the damn postal service. What do they say? Neither rain, nor snow, nor heat, nor gloom of night will stay these couriers of something or other. Well, that's what these guys are like. Nothing stops their precious barbecue. And the rest of us have to sit inside, just to avoid the smell. But then someone opens the window and, well, you can imagine. Steak. I could murder a steak.
This man who disappeared, Tamika said, trying to redirect the conversation.
Mayor? Ma, maybe. Something like that.
You said he worked on special aircraft?
That's what he said. I didn't say Jack.
What do you think he meant by that?
Something about how they performed, how they flew, I guess. But he never said he flew them. He was an engineer. I said that, right? Built the materials the planes were made of. Bragged about it, you might say. Though I try not to judge.
How they flew?
I don't know. He told this one story about how these R&D guys brought him a blue tile, made of some weird material. Said you couldn't tell if it was metal or plastic or ceramic. They told him to figure out what it was and build some more. He asked where they had got it from, and they told him that didn't matter. He was all, how am I going to figure out what the stuff is if you won't tell me anything about where it came from? And they said, that's why you make the big bucks. He liked telling everyone he made a mint, like we'd be impressed.
Did he say where he thought the tile came from?
Russia. Maybe China, said Chuck. Somewhere secret, from people who didn't want us to have it. Like it was recovered in some James Bond mission, and he couldn't really talk about it. Except that he did. Thought it made him cool. Jackass. Now he's off the barbecue list. Not so cool now, huh?
Tamika nodded thoughtfully, and looked out to where Katerina and the others were huddled round the grill in their coats.
You know where he went?
Never heard from him again.
And no one saw him arguing with your friend Fred?
There was no argument that I saw. And a falling out doesn't explain those other guys who showed up asking questions.
Who do you think they were?
No clue. Corporate security or government types, I'd say. Engineering is a high-dollar line of work. Someone wanted their secrets protected.
Unbidden, the thought of the paper dolls trailing across the empty church came to mind. Children. German names. The protected secrets of scientists imported from the ashes of Berlin. And the last piece of the puzzle slotted into place. German children. The offspring of all those Operation Paperclip researchers and engineers, who perhaps saw or heard things deemed classified long ago. Was that possible? Tamika stood up abruptly, the idea clear and sharp in her head, and turned to the window and the exclusive barbecue beyond. Katerina, half in and half out of a group who were talking and laughing, was looking directly at her.
27. Jersey. Guantanamo, Cuba, July 1946.
I still don't know what part Captain Jennings played in fast-tracking my sudden commitment to the Navy. But within weeks of our arrival in New York, I was in basic training at the Great Lakes facility north of Chicago. Early the next year, I was in Guantanamo, Cuba, for further training, while the USS Kitchener was being refitted, and spent my leisure time on deck drinking Coke. It was, of course, no accident that I would continue my career under Captain Jennings' command, though he kept his distance to avoid the appearance of favoritism. For all the hardships of training, life among the palm trees and haciendas, where the sailors cracked open green, freshly harvested coconuts filled with sweet milk on the beaches of the base's windward point, was like being on another planet. There's lots to say about life on a destroyer, but it's not relevant to my larger story, so, at least for now, I'm going to skip over it. We left port at the beginning of September 1946, heading south between Haiti and Jamaica, then down the east coast of Venezuela and Guyana. In the vast openness of the South Atlantic, we lost sight of land entirely, and went many days at a time without glimpsing another vessel as we skirted the great coastline of Brazil, finally pulling west again, in time to spy the coastal buildings of Montevideo looming off our starboard bow. I was told by a shipmate about the scuttling of the German pocket battleship Graf Spee in the first year of the war, and we peered over the side, hoping to see the shadowy outline of its wreckage as we sailed over it. But there was nothing. We entered Argentine waters and came to a full stop less than a mile from La Plata's shipyards, where the two German submarines were moored. We were met by a patrol boat flying the Argentine tri-band of pale blue and white, the escort for a pair of U.S. officials, one of whom, I was told, was an ambassador or consul. The ship was tense. There were, including officers, a little over 300 of us aboard, and we had been at sea for weeks. On deck, it was hot, and below deck, it was hotter, unventilated and saturated with the stench of unwashed bodies. We slept on deck, where it was cooler if we could, or in bunks four high, seeing the same faces, doing the same chores. We were waiting for something, anything to happen, and, more importantly, waiting to get off the damn ship. We'd come all this way, and now we were sitting in the harbor, waiting for some goddamned diplomats to say we could get on with our job or, better still, go ashore for a while. But we waited that first day, and 1 hour turned into two, and there was no sign of progress. When a hatch opened, it was only Billy Ray, the mess steward, a burly black man who ran the galley with an impatient efficiency that terrified me. "Stern," he bellowed, glaring at me. "Get your ass up here." I stared at him. He had never spoken to me directly before. Even the fact that he knew who I was thrilled me, though I felt something between pride and panic. "Me?" I said, getting hesitantly to my feet. "You," he said. "Why, God only knows." "What?" "Captain requested you by name," he said, moving back to the galley, and not bothering to see if I was following. "Here's a tray of coffee. Take it to the stateroom." "Coffee?" I muttered stupidly. "Yeah, you know what coffee is, don't you?" Billy Ray shot back, turning to give me the kind of level glower that would freeze a charging bear. "They grow it right here. In fact, offering our dried crap to these argy diplomats is like bringing the governor of Maine aboard and serving him canned lobster. But what the hell do I know? I'm just a damn cook. That tray there, you see it?" "Yes, sir," I said, staring at the tray with its cups and polished brass coffee pot. "So take it," he said, "and don't call me sir, boy. What's wrong with you?" "Yes, sir. Sorry, sir," I stammered. Billy Ray held the hatch open and watched me unblinkingly as I took the laden tray gingerly and stepped over the threshold. "And don't spill it," he said, adding as I moved unsteadily away, "Boy don't have the brain God gave a lemon." I was used to following orders without question, but the fact that I should have been singled out for this particular job was odd. When I reached the captain's stateroom, having just about managed to tip the contents of the tray all over me as I made it up the middle gangway and got the door open, he showed no sign of recognizing me.
Just set it there, Seaman, he said, nodding to the table upon which I saw various papers spread out, and a sheaf of black-and-white photographs. The small room felt crowded. The captain and his first officer were joined by the two diplomats in suits, an Argentine military officer in sunglasses and a pale blue jacket trimmed with heavy gold braid and epaulets, and two other uniformed men who were squeezed in against the wall. I did not know if I was supposed to offer coffee to everyone. There weren't enough cups. The captain spread the photographs out as he made room for the mugs, and I had to make my way round the table, pouring coffee over the shoulders of the seated men like a waiter. It irritated me, and I risked a look at the captain, though he did not look back. The Argentine officer spoke languidly in Spanish, splaying the fingers of one tanned hand for casual emphasis. As he finished, the slimmer of the two diplomats translated in clipped tones. "The internal arrangements of the U.S. Navy are not his concern," he says. "This is a matter of sovereignty. The vessels in question were surrendered to Argentina, not to the United States, and their extradition has not been cleared by President Perón's government." The captain said in passive as the Argentine officer put down his cup and continued his speech. This in turn was given in English by the increasingly frustrated translator. "He says that your crew are welcome to the hospitality of his great city, subject, of course, to all local rules and ordinances, and he suggests that they avail themselves of the opportunity, since your ship will not be permitted to take the aforementioned submarines back to your home country any time soon. He compliments you on the standard of your coffee," the translator concluded, "though he is, of course, lying." If that last was a joke, no one reacted as such. Instead, they nodded sagely, and it struck me that the dynamic reminded me of some of the crew's poker games. I moved to top off the Argentine officer's cup and froze. In front of him was one of the photographs. It showed three men in conversation. In the background, other people in what looked like German naval uniforms. But only the three in the foreground were in sharp focus, showing no awareness of the camera, as if it had been taken with a powerful lens from a distance. Two of them I did not recognize. The third, though out of uniform, had a distinctive sideways smile that I knew instantly. It was the ranking officer who had been visiting the Wenceslas mine the day Ishmael died. He had been talking to the scientists in the bell chamber. Ungerleiter had saluted him. I would have recognized him anywhere. "That's all, Seaman," said the captain, sweeping the pictures back into a manila folder as if annoyed that I had seen them. "Leave us," he said it roughly, as if I had done something wrong, and the Argentine officer gave me a look of amused condescension as I bustled out, my head swimming. "So?" Billy Ray demanded when I returned the tray to the galley. "What?" I asked, only half coming out of my reverie. "We going home with those subs or what?" I shook my head vaguely. "No," I said, in answer to his stare. "I don't think so, but we may be able to go ashore." "Better than nothing," he said. "You okay, boy? You look like you've seen a ghost." "Yeah," I said, unsure which remark I was agreeing with. The Argentine official left within the next 10 minutes, but the U.S. diplomat stayed an hour more. I was watching from below the bridge when the hatch opened and the captain showed them out. He watched them go, then looked down and around the deck. I was sure he was looking for me. I stepped sideways into the sun, and he nodded toward me once. It was, I believed, an invitation. He closed the door behind me as soon as I reached the stateroom. "Sit down, Jersey," he said. "I'm sorry if I was brusque with you before. I didn't want anyone to recognize what I'd seen in your face." "That I knew one of the men in the pictures?" I said. "Exactly," he said. The table had been cleared, and the pictures were gone. "The photos were taken by a U.S. journalist shortly after the U-boats arrived in La Plata. I've had them since Guantanamo." "Was it just the one man you knew?" he asked. I thought, trying to recall the photographs, but nodded. "I think so,"
I said. From Wenceslas? He asked. I only saw him once, I said, for a few minutes. But you are sure it was him? Positive, I said. I would never forget that face. You know his name? I shook my head. I do not think he was stationed at the mine, I said. Jennings smiled ruefully at that. No, he said. He was not. An Obergruppenführer of the SS would not be stationed in a mine. I stared at him in disbelief until he inclined his head. His name is Hans Kammler, he said. An engineer by training, Nazi by ideology. Worked his way up to command a host of construction projects and facilities. Concentration camps, extermination procedures, special weapons testing and construction. Under that last category, he ended the war in charge of the Nazi jet aircraft and V-2 rocket program. A very powerful man, and one who is supposed to have died of self-inflicted cyanide poisoning near Prague in May of last year. Yet here he is, walking around, big as life. For a moment, his eyes narrowed, and he stared thoughtfully at nothing. Captain, I said, framing something I had wanted to say for a long time. What are we doing here? Captain Jennings gave me a shrewd look. We are here to escort those two U-boats up to Virginia, he said. You know that. Yes, sir, I said. And? Is there something on your mind, seaman? Well, sir, if you don't mind me saying so, sir, I said, and meaning no disrespect, sir. That sounds like bullshit, sir. He didn't shout me down or throw me out. He didn't even glare, but his right eyebrow raised in mildly quizzical surprise. Is that right? He said. Sir, yes, sir, if you don't mind me saying so, sir. At ease, Jersey, he said, fishing a cigarette packet from his breast pocket. Smoke? No, sir. Thank you, sir, I said, still a little stiff. He lit up and took a long, slow drag. Exhaled and considered the smoke, as if he were trying to read what he would say next into its gunmetal grayness. You are right, to a point, he said, though I could have you up for insubordination for saying so. Our official mission remains to escort the U-boats stateside, but the paperwork hasn't cleared yet. We came anyway, I said. We're a little early, he conceded. Giving us time to do what? I asked. Well, now, he mused aloud. That seems to be the question. Is this strictly a Navy mission? I asked, emboldened by his confessional manner. Escorting the U-boats is a Navy mission, yes, he said. But there are other objectives in play, which are best addressed by other elements of the government and armed forces. Such as? Have you ever heard of the National Intelligence Authority? He asked. I shook my head. No, he said. It didn't exist last year. What about MI6, the British Intelligence Gathering Service? Again, I shook my head. Spies, Jersey, said Jennings. It's the beginning of a new world order. President Truman was impressed by what the British commandos accomplished in what they were calling covert warfare against the Nazis. And he was, to say the least, dismayed by what happened at Pearl Harbor. By what we didn't see coming. Now we have the Soviets to deal with, so resources are being diverted, agencies created, so that we'll be able to fight the coming intelligence and information wars. I blinked at him. Intelligence? I repeated, unsure of how he was using the word. Secrecy, he said. Not battles in uniforms and flags. People who watch, who listen, who mislead the enemy. And you work for one of these agencies? I asked. You know what we learned from Pearl Harbor? He said, ignoring my question. The same thing the Italians learned from Taranto in 1940. The same lesson taught by every kamikaze attack that sent one of our ships to the bottom of the ocean. We learned that the days of the Navy are gone. Ernie King might tell you different. But the days of wars, nations being won and lost by ships, have passed. We now live in the age of the air power. One airplane, cheaply made, and flown by a single pilot, can destroy a state-of-the-art battleship and everyone on board. One airplane carrying an atomic bomb can end a war. And I'm a career Navy man. I wish I didn't have to admit the Navy is finished, but I do. I said nothing. His voice was level, but it was taking an effort to keep it so. A version of the world is passing away, he said, and a new one will take its place. So this National Intelligence Authority, I said, you work for them? As long as it doesn't run contrary to my naval duties, he admitted. Yes, unofficially. I frowned, unsure what to do with this new information. I'm still the captain of this vessel, he said, until my superiors decide there's a conflict of interest in my being associated with both entities. Which superiors? I asked tartly. I could not help feeling betrayed. I had joined the Navy because of him, and all the time he'd been taking orders from someone else. As I said, there is as yet no conflict of interest. He said it firmly, but relented a little when he saw my face. I'm sorry if you feel misled, Jersey. This is all confidential, and I must ask you to keep it that way. My concern here is that prominent Nazis, officers, engineers, and possibly some of their most dangerous equipment escaped the fall of Berlin. Some of what was salvaged may be here, and some of these men may feel their defeat is only temporary. What could they have brought that you are so worried about? I shot back. The war is over. The battles are over, he said. But if you're fighting a war of minds and hearts, it's never truly over. And if you no longer need those tanks and thousands of uniformed soldiers, how are you going to win a war without soldiers? I asked. Same way we forced the surrender from the Japanese, he said grimly, with weapons so appalling that no one will fight against them. For a second, I just gaped at him. You think the Nazis were building an A-bomb at Wenceslas? I said. It would fit Kammler's profile, he said. The technology was clearly already under development. We don't know how far along they were, or what they may have been able to build. But imagine if they had one. We dropped ours from bombers, but they already had rockets that flew hundreds of miles. The V-2s the Nazis fired at London, a program that fell under Kammler's control. Imagine those rockets, equipped with nuclear warheads. You got that image in your head? Yes, sir. Good. Keep it there while you consider your answer to my next question. How would you like to be a secret agent? I did not hesitate. What do you need me to do? I said. 28. Wilfred de Brouwer. Belgium, November 29th. 1989 to March 30th, 1990. It began in November near Liege, a largely French-speaking city in Wallonia. The medieval town-turned-modern steel producer sits close to the Dutch and German borders, where the rivers Meuse and Orth meet. It is, depending on how you calculate such things, the third or fourth largest city in Belgium. It fell to the Germans during both World Wars, and was pummeled by V-1 and V-2 missile strikes between its liberation by the Allies and the final Nazi collapse. 45 years later, its people turned their eyes to the night sky once more, this time in wonder and disbelief. 12 miles to the east of Liege, across low rolling country on the road between Eupen and Ketenis, a pair of policemen were on routine patrol, when they observed what seemed to be a large triangular object with white lights at its corners and a red light in the center moving slowly over a field, perhaps 200 meters from the road, at an altitude of a little more than that. As they watched, the shape seemed to change directions, moving directly overhead and onto the village of Eupen, where it hovered in almost complete silence over the Lac de la Jalep Dam for the better part of an hour, before heading southwest towards Belen Spa, and then quickly out of sight. The police officers called the sighting in and, since their report was corroborated by other policemen and the general public, the Air Force base at Beerset was alerted. Having already detected the object on radar, an AWACS aircraft was dispatched to investigate, coming into the area from Gelsenkirchen. Sightings continued to come in for the next 2 hours, from locations throughout the Liège region, and from border towns in Holland and Germany. 30 groups of witnesses and 3 separate police patrols claimed to observe the lights in the sky. Later, the original 2 officers reported seeing a considerably larger triangle rise up from behind some trees and ascend quickly, before moving in the direction of the road at about 50 miles an hour. This was how it began. It continued through the ensuing weeks and months, culminating on the 30th of March, the following year, when, approaching midnight, local police stations in Wavre near Brussels were flooded with calls reporting strange lights in the sky that seemed to indicate a triangular object. The police reported the sightings to the Glans radar station, part of the NATO defense group, which confirmed that they were reading an object apparently cruising at about 3,000 meters. The Glans readings were further confirmed by the airbase at Semirzaki. These were the last days of the Soviet Union, only weeks after the non-Russian states of Moldova and Lithuania had voted to throw the communists out of their governments, acts to which the Soviet army responded with a military and economic blockade, allegedly to protect the rights of ethnic Russians like those killed earlier in the year in Azerbaijan. It was only a few months since the Berlin Wall had been torn down, and Western Europe was watching closely for signs of old-school Soviets attempting a counter-coup that might have included smash-and-grab military actions. Fearing a hostile incursion, and detecting no identifying transponder signal from what looked like a slow-moving aircraft, Belgian Air Force Colonel Wilfred de Brouwer scrambled 2 Belgian F-16 fighters stationed at Brevecom. The pilots of these planes, guided by the Glans radar, were unable to make visual contact with the triangles, but their instruments showed the presence of an unidentifiable mass moving at speed through the sky. They attempted to lock their chase radar onto the target, but when their instruments indicated a successful target acquisition, permitting the deployment of missiles, the target dropped precipitously, disabling the weapon's lock. The object then moved erratically, seeming to take evasive action each time the fighters attempted to lock on, moving at speeds in excess of 1,500 kilometers an hour, in ways that would produce unendurable G-forces on the pilot of a conventional aircraft. The object moved to the skies above Brussels, changing direction at speeds the F-16s couldn't begin to match, appearing and disappearing from radar, in ways suggesting either a failure of the F-16's onboard systems, or else it had dropped too low to be detected, vanishing in the lights of the city below. To Colonel de Brouwer, the movement seemed deliberate, because at such low altitudes, the density of the air limited the F-16s to speeds under 1,300 kph. 3 times, the cat-and-mouse game played out over the next 75 minutes, the object diving to safety, just as the fighters were about to complete their weapons lock. Numerous witnesses on the ground, including police officers, reported watching the whole encounter, though the object generated no supersonic boom, and no windows were blown out, as would be expected at that altitude and velocity, suggesting some form of propulsion that defied conventional analysis. After the events of that night, the data accumulated by the Belgian Air Force was, for the first time, shared with scientists and research groups, who attempted to explain what had happened with a range of possible scenarios. Could the object have been some form of balloon? No, said the expert witnesses. The meteorological conditions had been thoroughly analyzed, and could in no way account for the movement of the object. They asked if it could have been a meteor, or piece of falling space junk, but were told that the trajectory of such things did not fall into accord with the unidentified object, whose recorded radar signature indicated numerous changes of directions as it zigzagged across the sky. Neither could the object have been the undocumented incursion of a known stealth aircraft, such as an F-117, due to the absence of the sonic boom, and the moments when the object flew at no more than 40 kph, more than 200 kph slower than the stealth fighter's minimum operating velocity. Moreover, The military attaché to the American embassy expressly denied that any such U.S. stealth aircraft had been stationed in Belgium or had operated in its airspace. Several prominent scientists issued outlandish statements, saying that the only logical conclusion was that the object was of extraterrestrial origin. Countless pictures and videos were shot in the course of the various events over Belgium, some of them generating impressive images of triangular craft with lights at the corners, some suggesting infrared beams. Many were too small or blurred to present useful detail, and those that did were accused of fakery, though some remain compelling to this day, at least to believers. Whatever actually happened, the Belgian Triangle Wave remains one of the most witnessed and best-documented UFO sightings in human history. Its true nature remains a mystery. 29. Allen, Dreamland, Nevada. It was 2 days before Allen set foot in the Locust again. No explanation was offered for the delay. He found that, for all his existential angst about the nature of the craft, he wanted nothing more than to be in it again, to explore its strange capabilities, and to test his own. He worried that the powers that be were having serious doubts about his continuation in the program. That was his new greatest fear, that he'd flunk out, that he'd never be allowed up there again. 48 hours after his beer with Marat at the Little Ali Inn, there was a knock at the door of his room. An orderly he didn't recognize saluted, a flight suit folded in his arms. "Time to suit up, Major," he said without preamble. "I'll wait." Allen closed the door and dressed, splashing water at his face and staring hard at himself in the bathroom mirror. He looked pale in spite of his spell in the desert. Too much time indoors. He looked tired, too. And there had been a slight quiver in his fingers when he zipped up the suit. That would not do. Allen had been shown the future the last time he'd stepped into that strange black triangle. He'd seen it in all its dazzling glory and wonder. And he'd flinched, at least at first. Morat and Hatcher had seen it. That mental twitch that said, "I don't think I'm ready for this." He would not do that again. The decision hardened his blue-green eyes. He splashed a little more of the cool tap water in his face, toweled himself dry and left his room, nodding curtly to the orderly as if he were being given a ride to the airport. He rode alone on the blacked-out bus during the 20-minute ride to Papoose Lake. The ride took longer than he thought, and he couldn't help worrying. Was he not going to fly tonight? Was he to be quizzed or reprimanded first? Surely if he was being thrown out, disciplined, or even just subjected to more of those maddening tests, they wouldn't have made him suit up first. The bus stopped, and Allen got out. They were close to the cliffs. He inhaled the early evening air and gazed off over the dry lake bed, his flight helmet dangling from his right hand. It would be another clear Nevada night, cloudless, a good night for flying. The back of his neck prickled with the thrill of hope. He turned towards the outcrop concealing the door into the cliff face, but the orderly said, "This way, Major," and walked along the cliff face itself towards, as far as Allen could see, nothing. Allen went with him, the two men silent as the daylight faded in the west, and the rocks cast their long shadows across the desert floor. They walked 150 yards, and then the orderly stopped and pointed back to the mountain ridge they had just driven around on the bus. "Do you see that peak right there, sir?" said the orderly. "The highest one?" "Yes," said Allen, thinking that this was an odd time for a lesson on local geology. "I respectfully invite you to fix your eyes on it." "What?" Allen said, half turning to face the man. "Please?" Allen did so. In his peripheral vision, he saw the orderly reach to the cliff wall. There was a click, a hum, and a long drawn-out hiss. "You may look," said the orderly. Allen turned back to him, irritated at being treated this way. his annoyance instantly vanished. Where the cliff wall had been, there was an open hangar, lit with the flat greenish light of fluorescent strips hung from a high ceiling, and the harder blue-white spotlights angled from above the hangar door into the great space on the cliffside. The floor was clean, smooth concrete, the walls immaculately white, and the concealed room was perhaps 200 feet across and 50 feet deep. Doors at either end suggested that there were perhaps similar chambers on either side of it. Four locusts sat on the polished concrete, balanced on tall, spindly landing gear, ending in little wheels. Morat, dressed in his flight suit and cradling his helmet in the crook of one arm, stood beside one of them, talking to three men in dark blue overalls, and a man in a suit with a narrow, old-fashioned black tie and horn-rimmed glasses. One of the men in overalls glanced over his shoulder, considered Alan for a second, then looked away. No one spoke to him until Morat turned.
"Major," he said, nodding. "Ready?"
"When you are," said Alan, trying to sound casual. One of the engineers turned and gave him a slightly quizzical look, as if he had said something funny, or weird, or something, then turned away. The man in the suit was considering a clipboard, as if Alan wasn't there. Then he nodded, and one of the locusts was hitched to an electric cart for towing outside.
"I have to warn you, Major," Morat said. "What you are about to do may test your nerves."
"I'm sure I can handle it," he said, sounding more confident than he felt. It was difficult to imagine what would be more unsettling, more alarming, more thrilling than last time. He found out soon enough. They went through the same pre-flight checklist and guided the locust out and into a steady, silent hover over Groom Lake as the sun went down. "Now," said Morat, "let's get some miles under your belt."
"Where to?"
said Alan, excitement crackling within him like electricity.
"East," Morat answered. "We want to stay in the dark. Watch this gauge here for indications of the sun's position and your current location, and any destination coordinates you program in. This map screen will home in on any location in the world. Once input, this dialog box here will let you know your flight route, any necessary changes to cabin pressure, and any potential interferences or risks."
"Including passing through foreign airspace?"
"We're off the grid up here, Alan. If we can get there, the high ground is ours. There's not a conventional fighter flying for any nation in the world that can catch us. Most of them don't have the equipment required to even see us, if we don't want them to."
"Okay," said Alan, registering the word conventional, and trying not to give away the kid in a candy store exhilaration he was feeling.
"What do you think? Boston? New York?
We can come back that way, but the UK won't see sunrise for another half hour or so. Let's check it out."
Alan's hesitation was only momentary. He tapped London on the world map, leaving the altitude, speed, and other navigational concerns at their default settings. He gave Morat a look, and the other man nodded. They were both still wearing the visors of their helmets up. Alan assumed that the cockpit had automatically pressurized. Though in ways more efficient and unobtrusive than on any aircraft he had ever been on. He began moving the locust manually, guiding it with the toggle, controls on his armrest, increasing the speed to 600 knots, then 850, turning into the craft's new direction as it sped across the dark sky. He saw their movement on the consoles and the windows, but it felt like they were sitting in someone's oddly decorated living room, albeit one that throbbed slightly, like they were over a laundry room. After a couple of minutes, he tried the preset coordinates, hitting the auto-guidance engagement under Morat's watchful eye. The ship seemed to shimmer slightly, and for a moment, the speed gauge registered an astonishing speed. 1,200 knots, then 2,000, then 4,000. The sensors indicating the view below winked out, and the stars Alan could see through the cockpit canopy seemed to move. He checked the map and saw their breathtaking trajectory. harrowing out over the Virginia shore and the featureless waters of the Atlantic. Alan stared at the readouts around him. According to the speed gauge, they were doing something in the vicinity of Mach 7, which, even without the complete lack of G-force trying to peel the skin and muscle from his face, was impossible. Nothing could go that fast. Marat watched him, reading his eyes. Alan decided to shift focus. "What's this display?" he said. "Weapons systems. I thought you'd studied them." "In a classroom," said Alan. "Lasers. Kind of different up here with the Millennium Falcon." "The what?" asked Marat. "Seriously?" said Alan. "Star Wars?" "Oh," said Marat. "Don't think I ever saw it." "Them. There's more than one?" "You need to get out more," said Alan. "Speaking of which," said Marat, "mind if we give London a miss? The pubs will be closed, and it's too early for the Great British Breakfast."
"Sure," said Alan.
"What had you in mind?"
"Wiltshire," said Marat, tapping a point on his map some ways west of the capital. Alan had never heard of it.
"What's there?" he asked.
"Quiet," said Marat.
And for a second, Alan wasn't sure if the word was a demand or an answer to his question. They had been traveling, according to the internal chronometers and readouts, assuming they could be trusted, for 47 minutes, when the craft suddenly slowed to a drifting, hovering halt.
"Bring her below the cloud deck," said Marat.
Alan did so, dropping the Locust to 1,000 feet, finding the canopy overhead spotted and streaked with rain.
"England," said Marat.
"Typically cold and miserable."
"It could be just a hose or shower head," thought Alan madly. "Maybe we never left the hangar."
"Check this out," said Marat, nodding to one of the lower windows. Alan looked. Through the misty, rain-streaked darkness, he saw what he took to be hills rolling out below them, gray in the darkness, save where a single pale shape seemed to leap across the turf. It looked like it had been sketched from above by a confident painter, a few disconnected flicks of his brush capturing...
What?
A deer?
No.
A horse.
"What the hell?"
said Alan, staring. "The Uffington White Horse," said Marat. "Cut into the chalk hillside a few thousand years ago. Like a signpost."
"To what?" asked Alan,
all his skepticism momentarily forgotten. Marat shrugged.
"Stonehenge is that way," he said, gesturing vaguely. "But I don't like to go there. Too many gawkers at all hours."
"Stonehenge?" said Alan. "Are you serious?"
"Of course."
"Let's go." Marat started to shake his head, but he saw the seriousness in Alan's face and knew that this was about more than sightseeing.
"Suit yourself," said Marat, frowning. "It's less than 40 miles. You can drive."
Alan ignored the deliberate incongruity of that last word and maneuvered the Locust north, tracking their location on the scrolling map as he did so, using a ribbon of road marked on the map as the A346. To guide them at an easy 120 knots per hour. As they got close, Marat shifted in his seat.
"Turn the lights off," he said. "This is farm country. Even without sky-watching tourists, people are up at all hours."
Alan did so, slowing the craft and dropping it to 200 feet.
"Where can we sit down?" he asked.
"We're not landing," said Marat. For the first time since Alan had met him, he looked out of his element. Anxious.
"Sure we are," said Alan,
his gaze fixed on the map screen, which he had toggled to show what the ship's sensors actually saw. A video feed marked with spots of glowing color, overlaid with heat sensors, not unlike weapons targeting systems Alan had used many times.
"This part of the field looks pretty level."
"If anyone sees us here."
"There's no one around,"
said Alan, gazing out over the circle of standing stones.
"Look for yourself."
"There's a perimeter rail around the walkway," said Marat. He sounded petulant as well as uncertain.
"Then I'll land inside it," said Alan.
He wouldn't really, but he felt in control for the first time in weeks, and was taking a vindictive delight in watching Marat squirm.
"Don't worry.
I won't scratch the paintwork.
Or destroy a World Heritage site. That either, said Alan. If I can land a Harrier on a carrier, I think I can do this.
I don't think that's the issue, said Murat. Come on, Alan. Don't make me override your controls.
The radio came to life.
Come in, Phoenix. This is flight control. Over.
There goes our shore leave, said Alan with a sigh.
The relief on Murat's face was unmistakable.
Phoenix here, flight control. What can I do for you?
Location and altitude looking strange to us, Phoenix. Time to return to base.
Roger that, flight control, said Alan,
punching the controls and shooting Murat a grin.
Be right there.
30. Jennifer. London.
Jennifer's eyes moved from the Interpol ID to Latrange's, or Chevalier's, handsome face, and back.
So when you accuse me of being all cloak and dagger, she began.
Touché, he said. The word changed him, made him sound French in ways he hadn't before. Jennifer found that she did not know what to say. She'd barely known the man who had called himself Latrange, but she knew the man in front of her, the agent, even less.
You want to tell me what's going on? She said at last.
This couldn't have come at a worse time, he said. Maynard has been under police scrutiny for years. Insider trading, smuggling, money laundering, financing hostile groups.
Terrorists?
Indirectly, said Chevalier.
Why?
That's what we've been trying to find out. I was assigned to the task force 3 years ago and got a seat on the board a year after that.
How?
Contacts, most of them spurious, payoffs, and the ability to be useful. An international police force can open a lot of doors, get things done. She didn't know what that meant, and when she looked at him, he shrugged and looked away, not proud of himself, even if he was one of the good guys.
They were wary of me, he said, as you so shrewdly observed. I haven't been admitted to every hall of the Inner Sanctum yet.
And you're thinking that with my father's data you might not need to?
No, he said quickly. I'm thinking that if anyone hears you have access to that data, your life won't be worth the price of a pint. I'm trying to verify the scale of the threat. You are sure no one knows you have seen these files?
Only you.
He nodded and then, apparently on impulse, said,
Why me?
What do you mean?
Jennifer replied, coloring slightly.
I mean that if you had chosen any of the other men from that boardroom to confide in, you would almost certainly be dead soon after. So why did you choose me?
Jennifer looked out on Earl's Court Road, watching a woman with a pushchair and plastic bags of groceries, cautiously crossing the street.
Something my father said, she replied absently. And you were kind to me at the meeting.
Under the circumstances, given the risk she had taken, it sounded absurd. But he smiled, apparently pleased, and gave a Gallic shrug of acceptance.
It wasn't a great explanation, said the shrug, but it would do.
So what do you know about sweep? Asked Jennifer, keen to push past the moment.
Not much, to be honest. It's a very specific network of funding streams tied to various aerospace concerns dotted all over the globe. Mainly R&D, but also, we think, operation.
Operation of what?
I was hoping you could tell me.
Me? Jennifer exclaimed.
Why would I know anything about it? I just found out it existed.
You were around your father a lot growing up, Miss Quinn. Did you never see or hear anything that might connect him to this kind of thing?
What kind of thing?
Aerospace? You mean rockets and stuff?
No.
Anything of that sort. Aircraft development, perhaps.
She shook her head, but even as she did so, something tugged at the edge of her memory. Something old and indistinct from a long time ago.
She was quite small. It was night, and she was standing outside her father's office, cold in her nightdress, looking through the crack of the door. She didn't want to bother him when he was busy.
What? Asked Chevalier. You looked miles away.
Sorry, she said. Nothing.
The half-memory had unsettled her, for reasons she couldn't recall, and she wanted to change the subject.
What do we do now?
I talk to my superiors and we get you somewhere safe, said Chevalier. If these men find out you're about to expose them, you'd have no more than an hour.
Their resources are as limitless as their ruthlessness. Give me a moment.
She blinked again. The situation felt surreal, like something out of a movie.
Okay, she said.
Minutes later, Jennifer was in the passenger seat of Chevalier's black BMW, speeding out of central London westbound on the M4, Taylor Swift playing on the stereo. The Interpol agent had said very little since shepherding her to the car, his manner now all business. As they left the pub, he'd taken her arm, guiding her step by step, his eyes flashing around the street, alert and watchful as a president's security detail. It should have made her feel safe, but it didn't. She felt like a target.
First time I've been alone with a man close to my age in weeks, and he's my bodyguard.
Was my father involved? She asked him, as they drove past Chiswick and left the river behind. In the money laundering and the rest of it, I mean?
Chevalier gave her a swift, sidelong glance, then returned his eyes to the road.
He may not have known the extent of it until recently, he said, and I think he decided he wanted no further part of it. One of our operatives approached him, but he was suspicious, I guess.
Did he know about you?
I don't think so. But he knew something was going on. I think he was willing to turn. In another few weeks, we would have known for sure.
But someone got to him first.
So far as we know, he killed himself. We assumed he wanted out, but didn't dare try to take the rest of them down.
He didn't kill himself.
You have evidence for that?
Nothing that would stand up in court, said Jennifer sadly. But I'm sure of it.
Chevalier said nothing. He seemed to be checking his mirrors a lot, and he was certainly the fastest car on the road. He was very calm on the driver's seat, weaving around other vehicles with little more a twist of his wrist. It made him seem efficient, professional. It made her feel the opposite, clumsy, amateurish, vulnerable.
Where are we going? She asked.
Somewhere safe. You have the files with you?
Yes.
And you didn't copy them?
Not yet.
Should I have?
We can make a safety copy, he said.
A pause.
So this safe place, she began. Where is it?
Near Heathrow, he said. There's someone I want you to talk to. One of my colleagues who can look after you. You can't stay with me without blowing my cover. You may have to go to ground for a little while. You can send Deacon a text saying you've been called back to Africa. That will explain your absence, and why no one can reach you.
How long?
Weeks? Months? I'm not sure. But it will be somewhere nice. That last was added, because he sensed her resistance.
Months?
They turned south at a roundabout and headed towards the airport, then left the main road. The area was built up in a desultory suburban way. There were hedge groves lining the highway, playing fields, a school, and then, as he slowed, across the road to her left, the silos, gantries, and hoppers of a cement works. They turned in and circled around, past industrial trucks, across a paved parking lot, then down a dusty road that led alongside the works to a sudden opening, where she saw a clutter of silent shacks of weathered scrap wood and corrugated iron. Gravel roared under the tires. The car slowed and stopped, and suddenly, the world was very quiet.
"We are to wait in there," said Chevalier, nodding to one of the storage sheds as he unsnapped his seatbelt.
The rusted shed door hung half open. He reached into the back seat for his attaché case, then got out of the car, closing the door behind him with a soft thunk. Jennifer climbed out slowly, thinking hard. The cement works, several hundred yards away, was a snarling, clanking cacophony of sound.
The great open space she'd seen flashing in front of them as they drove in was a flooded quarry. Steep-sided, the water black, thick, and still. Suddenly, she didn't like the situation she found herself in. It was no more than that. A feeling, an impulse. But it hit her hard. And suddenly, everything felt wrong. She checked the ignition, but he'd taken the keys. Of course he had. Why wouldn't he? She studied the shed he'd gone into, its turquoise paint stained orange with rust. And she wondered why he hadn't waited for her. He'd been so attentive in the city, but here, it was like he'd wanted to reach the shed before her. To make sure it was safe? Or something else? She thought back to the pub, the way he'd feigned bewilderment when she first mentioned sweep. Is that a thing, or some kind of practice? A good dodge, a practiced liar. And then he had produced his Interpol card, and she decided to trust him, which is what she'd wanted to do. Had he guessed as much? She looked over to the shed. He hadn't asked her to bring her purse, the handbag that now held the flash drive, tucked into a zippered pouch, to the shed. That was odd, wasn't it? If they were meeting someone, and the data was vital, wouldn't he want to be sure she had it with her? But he had asked if she had the files with her, so maybe he just assumed she wasn't an idiot. Maybe. She took a step toward the hut, conscious of how alone they were. A plane soared overhead, its engines a thundering bellow that drowned out the steady growl of the cement works. Jennifer! He called to her from inside the shed. He didn't come to the door and look out. He stayed inside, deep in the shadowy recesses, and called to her. It was the first time he had used her first name. And then she knew. She knew before she saw him, before the gun with its long suppressor screwed into its barrel came up, and before the muzzle flashed. She knew, and she ran. The silencer didn't do the job she expected it to do. There was no discreet thud like in the movies. It was a bang. Anywhere else, it would have drawn attention. He fired again. She was moving, first instinctively back toward the car, then changing her mind and dashing around the side of the hut, so that he would have to come after her if he was to keep shooting. He did. She knew he would. She broke hard to the right, through a gateway and across another road of baked mud. Behind her, he fired again, and this time she heard the bullet, a thrumming streak through the air, inches from her head. It was followed by a muffled curse. She was still running, big, staggering strides. The road curved up toward the motorway, but the land around it was open and would provide no cover. She risked a look back, but could not see him. Then she heard the BMW's engine turn over and the car screech into reverse. She was already breathless, heart banging against her ribs, though that had more to do with panic than fitness. But even if she could get hold of herself mentally, her runner's legs couldn't beat out the BMW. She thought wildly about throwing herself in the turgid waters of the quarry and swimming to the other side. But that was stupid. It would just give him time to pick his shot. She ducked where a large field was screened from the cement works by a dense hedge of hawthorn brambles and low ancient trees. The thicket was only a few feet deep, though it stretched all around the field. If he saw her before she made it into cover, she was dead. She leapt the boggy ditch on the other side of the thicket and clawed her way through stinging nettles into the shade of a stunted beech tree, then pressed south through the densest part of the skinny strip of woods, back the way they had driven. Above her, a jet roared. Ignoring the hammering of her heart and the shriek of blood that rang in her ears, she forced herself to think of the purse, thrown ragged and flapping over her shoulder. Yes, she thought, as the car tore up the gravel road towards the motorway. Her passport would still be inside.
He would soon realize he'd lost her and turned back. If she could keep moving and stay hidden when he came hunting for her, she might make it to the airport. It was clear that Chevalier, or Latrange, or whatever the hell his real name was no Interpol agent. It was also clear that she wasn't safe where she was. She wasn't safe anywhere in England. Surprisingly, the thought calmed her. She hadn't been comfortable in Chevalier's protection, but then she hadn't been comfortable in the Maynard boardroom, or even in her father's house. At least now she knew she could trust no one but herself. The idea was comforting. The BMW came roaring back. She had made it no more than a couple of hundred yards before he'd realized he was on the wrong trail. The narrow copse was as dense as before, the light dim and patchy, and she was as sure as she could be that he couldn't see her from the road unless she moved. She threw herself face down in the bracken, feeling a prickly vine lash her face, knowing she would get up nettled and bruised. She didn't move. The car barreled past in a flurry of dust and chippings, then braked hard. For a moment, it idled in the road, and she could almost hear his fury. She stayed exactly where she was, breathing shallowly out of the corner of her mouth, hands tucked in, the red purse concealed beneath her. Then the car was rolling slowly backwards, a soft panther creep that took it 20 or 30 yards past her. Then it stopped. She waited, her heart rate mounting again, as she heard the clunk of the car door. He'd gotten out. She listened. She could hear the grumble of the cement works in the distance, and the flat cawing of rooks in the field. But if he was walking toward her, stalking her, looking in her direction, she couldn't say. Was this how her father had died? Some strange, absurd game of cat and mouse that led to him plummeting from his office balcony. Had he been forced off by a man with a gun? This man? She closed her eyes and balled her fists. She heard footsteps on the road, then the car door, and then the BMW executed a rough and hurried 3-point turn, ramming its front end into the hawthorn that overhung the ditch. Then he was racing north again, and she was moving south. After 5 full minutes, timed on her watch, with no sign of the car, she allowed herself to venture into the field proper, so that her progress would be faster. In another 4, she'd crossed the road and was running hard across open country toward a far line of hedges. 10 more minutes, and she was pushing through a perimeter fence into a nursery, surrounded by ornamental cypresses and Japanese maples in oversized pots. Then there were houses, cut-price generic hotels, and a taxi rank. 10 minutes later, she was walking purposefully through the ticketing area of Heathrow Airport, looking for a restroom where she could clean up, and scanning the departure boards for a suitable destination. Doesn't really matter, she thought, so long as it's away from here. 31. Herman Salzberg, London. In a warm, expensively paneled office in Mayfair, Herman Salzberg extended his long legs under his desk and smiled a wide, slightly ghoulish smile. For a big man, he carried almost no body fat and gave the impression of being all sinew and bone, which was why the daughter of the late Edward Quinn had dubbed him the Skeleton Man. He hadn't minded, though he'd thought the child impertinent. He'd always liked the idea of scaring her. The skin of his face, sallow and close to the bone, stretched improbably, so that the grin looked like the death's head motif SS officers had once worn on their peaked caps. He didn't mind that either. But little Jennifer Quinn had become more than impertinent of late, and things had come to a head. "Tell me again," he purred into the phone, his eyes resting on the man sitting silently and patiently across the desk from him.
There's nothing more to say, said Latrange, made defiant by failure. She got away.
That, Daniel, said Salzburg, in his most unctuous voice, is the part I don't seem to be comprehending. That she escaped from you is regrettable, to say the least, given what she apparently suspects. But the fact that you seem to have no notion of where she might have gone is unacceptable.
He said it quietly, without rancor. He didn't need to do more.
Yes, sir, said Latrange. If she made it to the airport, I'll be able to find where she went. A consummation devoutly to be wished, said Salzburg. I suggest you do so. Immediately.
Call me back. He hung up without another word and smiled at his companion, before continuing their interrupted conversation in measured German.
Wird es ein Problem sein?
Asked Herr Manning, one of Maynard's other board members.
No, it won't be a problem, said Salzburg. You've seen Miss Quint's tenacity firsthand, but you've also seen her blundering cluelessness. This is not her world. We are not. She will scurry about, turning over the wrong stones, until we stub her out like a spent cigar. Though I doubt you will unearth anything particularly sensitive, it remains unclear how much she knows, or remembers.
That was very long ago.